Hey, good day, everybody. Welcome to another great episode of the OIG Roundtable. We got the full group here. Wade McFowell, retired assistant special agent in charge from the LA field office, now a member of our SIU investigative team. Matt Kachansky, retired OIG executive and on retired Northeast UPIC director and a member of our SIU investigative team. And Jason Eisengrind, who I've now just started saying Matt's counterpart. Jason, also senior executive from the OIG, went on to be the director of the UPIC West and is on one of our many leadership projects. You could see, although it looks like Matt, Wade, and I are in the same space, we're actually in our three separate conference rooms. Advisors growing by leaps and bounds. And so we have multi-level conference rooms here in our corporate offices, part of the Advise campus, apparently, is what it is. So today we want to talk about referrals in the SIU space. And, you know, I kind of jokingly say, you know, why do your referrals suck is kind of the moniker, but it's really, why aren't your referrals getting accepted? What are some of the issues with referrals? And I think the level set is that whenever we talk about referrals, I think colloquially people think about referrals as making referrals to law enforcement. And while the four of us come from a law enforcement background, we readily recognize, and we do a lot of this in our process improvement SIU work, is that referrals don't inherently need to be for law enforcement. Referrals can be internally to provider enrollment for some education about getting other providers put onto the credentialing. It could be internally for training and education and things of that sort. It could be to outside entities, non-law enforcement. Not everything is a referral to the OIG or in the commercial space, the FBI, or if there's federal employee health benefits, OPM, or workers' comp to postal OIG or something like that. There's a whole slew of external referrals. You could have boards of medical examiners, pharmacy boards, regulatory organizations, departments of banking and insurance for licensing of things like that. So, you know, we want to talk a lot about spend the time today talking about referrals and some of the trials and tribulations. And wait, I want to start with you because so as an ASAC, you reviewed a lot of referrals that would come into the OIG, hotline complaints, PSC program, safeguard contractor, then the ZPIC, UPIC. But, you know, one of the things that you do now on the contract that you're on is you make referrals to the state Medicaid Fraud Control Unit and the Medicaid Fraud Division for the plan that you're working on. And, you know, you and I have spoken a lot about this and we've talked a lot about this in our podcast is, you know, one of your focuses as coming from a law enforcement background is getting these referrals out to the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit and making referrals to law enforcement for law enforcement action. And some of those trials and tribulations have to do with, you know, consistency, and I think it's a combination of consistency and communication, right? So let's talk a little bit about that. Like, you know, one of the things that I think has been a topic of conversation is exactly that, is consistency. And part of that consistency comes from communication, right? So you have, you know, a referral you make to Mafuku and they don't want it. And then a week later, you make a referral relying upon conversations you had with them and they don't want it, right? And, you know, where do you see, you know, as some of that, like where do you see these issues on, you know, why do your referrals stink? Why doesn't anybody want to take a referral?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head on one of the main aspects, and that's the lack of consistency. I don't know how many times I've seen emails where we have like a workflow where generally if you get a case and you're working, you know, we all know every case is different, but there's certain workflows to follow. And you follow these steps, and then step number, whatever, five or six might be, it should be referred to, you know, one of, I think there's three or four different entities that we refer to. But then, you know, every once in a while we'll get an email and saying, you know, effective immediately, we will no longer refer this type of case to this agency. And so there was a meeting that I wasn't involved with that they decided we categorically don't want these cases anymore. So all of a sudden that becomes one that we used to refer that we're not doing now. So the consistency kind of fluctuates and changes, you know, I wouldn't say monthly, but pretty regularly. The other thing I think that's important to point out is a few kind of like elements of the referrals. One of the first ones I think is, and we've talked about this a number of times, but the thresholds, there has to be it's like an unwritten number. They don't want to publish it for obvious reasons, but the people working the cases and working the referrals have to know kind of what's the low dollar that each agency or each department will take as a referral. I used to say in some of our other podcasts with the OIG, and in every region it's different, but in LA, you'd be hard pressed to have a case that's worth less than $1 million being prosecuted by the United States Attorney's Office. You could pitch it elsewhere, the city attorney's office, the DA's office, but there's thresholds that I think everyone who's accepting referrals, they kind of have a dollar amount. And I don't see a lot of that in some of the stuff that I'm working now. I've made referrals for as low as $15,000. And I've been on calls where other agent or other investigators are pitching cases for as low as like $6,000. And I'm thinking, we're going to eat up $6,000 in paying the people that are sitting on this call. There's 15 people on the call and we're pitching a case for $6,000. To me, it doesn't make any sense.
Right. Yeah. Like that return on investment. Right. And you know, small case of that. But so let's talk about that for a second, because that's an important piece of the puzzle, right? Is this kind of fluctuating piece of the puzzle on the dollar amount, because, you know, at the end of the day, I think part of the pitch of a good referral is the dollar amount is part of it, but also what's the pattern and practice behind it, right? You may have a case, and I remember this is kind of a collateral discussion, but, you know, one of the things that we did, you guys know this, and Matt was the coordinator for this, was child support enforcement. One of the things that people don't really know about the OIG is that we were responsible for doing interstate child support enforcement cases. There's a federal statute that says that if you're a non-custodial parent and you have and you live in a different state from the child and you have $10,000 or more in arrears, it's a felony punishable by 2 years in prison. And Matt was the coordinator for that, and we'll go on this like tour of doing this. And I remember having one case in New Jersey where each time the non-custodial parent would hit like a certain dollar amount, the local county would issue a warrant for his arrest. In New Jersey, it was done through the probation department. And so he would get a warrant for his arrest. The sheriffs would go arrest them. He'd make the payment. The arrears would drop. And so it would never really, you know, but so we had this pattern. It almost looked like, you know, like the stock market, you know, every other month it would do this. And so he never really hit these, you know, he would be at 10,000, 12,000, but he had this pattern. And, you know, what ultimately sold the case to the U.S. Attorney's Office for this was exactly that. Like, he played the system. And I think if we bring this back to the healthcare space, is that it's not always the dollar amount. It's what is the pattern behind what that fraud scheme is. And I think that oftentimes part of that referral conversation needs to be, you know, kind of explaining that, right? And I think that, you know, unfortunately, that sometimes gets lost in the translation. Like, it may be a $6,000 case, but is it a $6,000, is it one claim for chemotherapy where you can definitively demonstrate that the patient was away on vacation and the provider is claiming that they gave them the chemotherapy? Like, it's not a matter of transposing member IDs or something where it's a mistake, right? Like, some of that is the pattern.
Yeah. And you obviously have to take into a lot of factors, and it's not strictly a threshold and a dollar amount, whether or not you're going to work the case. There could be other factors. You always talk about if there's patient harm, that's a big one, then kind of the threshold doesn't really matter. That has to be addressed. And this case that I was referring to, that there was nothing really remarkable. It wasn't, as you say, like a one shot chemotherapy where the patient was gone, or it wasn't even something that you could look at and say, this is going to take no effort to prosecute or to resolve. It's just a matter of filing it. It was an investigation that still required a lot of time. And it was just, you know, the kind of the overall view of it was that it wasn't worth it. But other than that, but I mean, as far as the other things that you really, I think, have to look at is, again, we've talked about this, but we have, if you have the workflow and it says, you know, step six or seven, whatever, is you submit a credible allegation of fraud. I think there's a lot of different views on that. Where I look at a credible allegation of fraud, I break it down. First of all, you know, we don't have to talk about what credible is, but first of all, is the information credible, reliable, from a reliable source? But then the other part is, the allegation of fraud were a lot of cases that I'm probably supposed to be submitting a credible allegation of fraud, I would question whether it's actual fraud, like provable fraud. Is it closer to being, you know, waste or abuse, or as you said earlier, even like technical violations?
Right.
Coming from the OIG world, I have a different view of what fraud is and what it would require to prove it. And if it's a criminal case, we're talking about criminal intent. So a lot of these cases that following the workflow, I should be submitting a credible allegation of fraud, where from my history, I wouldn't be taking that route. But if that's what they want, so I want
to close the loop on that, because, you know, when we're talking about a credible allegation of fraud, you know, that's going to be kind of this evaluation of the facts and the circumstances. And, you know, one thing, and I think, you know, we've talked about this a bunch of times, is, you know, doing three interviews with members and a probe sample of five claims, and then trying to make a referral on that is probably going to be something where there's a shortfall, right? So, you know, trying to make a referral is making your best pitch to say, hey, this is where the problem is, right? So part of that is kind of, you know, in the auditing world, they'll talk about ticking and tying, and, you know, making sure that you've got it all, you know, back to the initial issue, which is, you know, are three beneficiary interviews or member interviews and a probe sample of five records, is that really enough on a credible allegation of fraud? And I think the answer is going to unequivocally, unfortunately, it's going to be the answer that lawyers always give, is it depends. And I think you have to look at each case individually. But, you know, certainly I think that when you are putting together a referral, right, you're trying to make your best sales pitch for that case to go. And, you know, doing something that is short-sighted, you know, I don't think that in any scenario three beneficiary interviews and a probe sample are going to do it. And I know that, you know, we would have conversations with the ZPICs, the UPICs, PSCs, whoever it was at the time, on the Medicare cases, where there would be a probe sample of 10 records done, and then they would extrapolate from a probe sample and say the estimated overpayment, you know, it's like watching Dr. Evil. The extrapolated overpayment's $1 billion. And you would say, extrapolated overpayment's $1 billion. How? Right. So part of that is the credibility of the investigative, the tenacity of the investigation, right? So it's making that pitch to come up to say, yes, this is credible, because it's more than, you know, just those couple of things. So Jason, I want to go to you, because this kind of lends into that, which is that you've got your different stakeholders. And I know we talk a lot about this whole premise of this law enforcement liaison, but, you know, at one point you were wearing a lot of different hats at the UPIC. And it doesn't change. If you're the SIU manager, you're the UPIC director, you know, UPICs are essentially the SIU for Medicare. You're wearing a lot of different hats, and you've got competing needs. The U.S. Attorney's Office may have one set of things that they're looking for, a state Medicaid fraud control unit, an Office of Medicaid Inspector General, the FBI, all of that. And it's sort of, you know, how do you rope all of that in together to make sure that when you are making a proper external referral, that you're hitting the mark on all of those things?
Well, first, if I could beg your indulgence, I just want to say thank you to the folks that came up to Matt, myself, Jean Marie, our CEO, and Rachel, our president, at the NAMPI conference last week. That's the National Association of Medicaid Program Integrity, and providing us feedback on what you like to hear, and that you're getting some value out of the podcast. That's very helpful, and thank you. It was great seeing you all. So this, I'm trying not to be long-winded, but there's a lot to unpack with this. So Eric touched on this earlier, where it's about knowing your stakeholder. So I think oftentimes people, especially in the commercial space, they understand the FBI has a healthcare fraud squad. What they may not realize is that the postal inspectors, and also Postal OIG have an interest in healthcare, OPM, Inspector General. Any number of other law enforcement agencies have a stake in this. So it, there are many places to shop it. And you could really die on the vine trying to shop it to death, right? So you got to be careful. So you really need to know what your stakeholders are, or who your stakeholders are, and what their parameters are for accepting a referral. Because you don't need the effort of spinning your wheels over something that is maybe tedious and mundane. And I frankly, in 1979 was when I made my first referral, and I was not in the law enforcement series at that point, but I thought I had information that was golden. And I wrote this 5 or 10 page report of this horrible, and back then Social Security was part of HHS. So I wrote this fraud referral up, and you know, basically it was thanks, but no thanks. And I couldn't believe it. And the reason why I couldn't believe it is, frankly, I hadn't yet earned my stripes or done my homework maybe to know exactly what the stakeholders' requirements are. So is it certainly patient harm might be right up at the top of the list. You mentioned about the oncology services. Well, I happen to do a field referral for Matt on a case 100 years ago where there was somebody providing oncology services to people that didn't need it. Does that step it up from the oncology services, but the guy was out of the country, or the gal was out of the country? Yeah, I think it does. It isn't about the Benjamins. It's also about the things that are priorities. It might be that right now, orthotics is a big hit. P-stems are popping up on your radar, and you want to, you know, your company wants to address it. So it's going to be about communication with your stakeholders and communication with your internal team to inform them where to go with it, and to minimize the amount of effort when it's not something that's going to fly on the other end. And having said that, I will say that it really is a profession. So Eric, you referred to, you know, when we first won the UPIC in the West, I was out meeting with a lot of U.S. attorney's offices, FBI, field offices, and whatnot, trying to arrange for that information. And it's a lot of work. And until we can find the right person to do that as a profession, it really does take up a lot of people's time, where if you're educating one or two people that have that, or if you have a small SIU and you still want this type of service, maybe this is a classic MBA rent versus buy analysis. Is it better to rent a piece of a law enforcement liaison from some other company, like, well, I don't know, maybe Advise? Or do you, you know, is it so prolific in your organization that you need that person? And Advise would be very happy to train the person and give them the more detailed pointers of what I've alluded to today.
Well, and I think part of that is also that the person who serves in that role of law enforcement liaison, it's not just law enforcement. They're liaisoning with external stakeholders, but also maybe also doing some work with internal stakeholders and understanding those differences. And I know I've said this before, but you know, there was a period of time in the District of New Jersey where if you had an ambulance transport case and it didn't have some sort of a plus factor, that they weren't interested in it. They would say, handle it as an administrative case, treat it as an overpayment, send it to Office of Counsel, to the Inspector General. We just knew that was the case. And that was a pretty straightforward thing. But then, you know, things become, you know, a little bit more esoteric, and having someone who kind of understands what the different stakeholders' interests are, because that really, I mean, it could be a full-time job. Meeting regularly with your external stakeholders is something that's important, because then you have to go back and communicate to your leadership. And this doesn't matter. It's not UPIC centric, right? We're spending a lot of time talking about SIUs because we're doing a lot of training and education and process improvement. And we're finding that this is a very, you know, regular thing. You know, we had a client here. They had engaged us on something where very, very small SIU, like the SIU was comprised of like two people. And I'm convinced that the SIU investigator was also the person that was vacuuming the rugs and taking out the garbage at night. So, you know, but they didn't even understand how to make a referral. They were a Medicare Advantage plan. They had some fraud that they identified with someone who was a sales rep, and they had no idea how to refer it to anyone. And they called us up and they said, you know, I was on the phone with them. They had no idea where the local OIG office was. They had no idea who to contact. It was just one of those challenges. Jason, back to you.
One quick thing is document your communications, because you may or may not know, many times these investigations that do become law enforcement referrals will go on for quite some time, and the stakeholder players will change, and you're going to want to be able to have a record of, hey, well, this is what we were told to do, even if it's just to be able to say to your own boss after they say, why did you wait around 2 years? You will be able to identify your communication.
Right. Strength. Yeah, it's a good point. So, Matt, I want to close out with you, because when you were the Northeast UPIC director, and I joke about this all the time, Northeast UPIC was the UPIC for my region in at the OIG. And I would see you in my office in Edison sometimes more than I saw some of my coworkers, because you would come for these regular meetings with some of the leadership of your team and have meetings with management, us as agents, to pitch and work on cases. And I think, you know, that's an important piece of the puzzle, right? So it's regular communication. What is making the referral, you know, we always used to love the sexy, what made it a sexy referral? And what were the things that were making referrals not look good? You know, why did the referrals suck that you were trying to make? But, you know, one of the things that we talk about is, let's not get to the last page of the book to find out what the problem is, right? Like it's putting together a referral. And this doesn't change. And I think the thing that people need to fully kind of ingest and embrace is that internal referrals are as important as external referrals. And being in a position to pitch the issue to other departments within the SIU, within the payer, are just as important as making a referral to law enforcement. There's a whole bunch of things that can go on. There's training, education, credentialing, provider enrollment, right? And it's getting to the point early on in the book and not waiting to the end. Right, Matt?
Yeah, absolutely. Just if Jason keeps making such good statements, can we move him out of the locker room and get him up into the conference room? He just seems lonely down there.
We can. Yeah,
he does a good job cleaning the lockers and stuff, but gosh.
Well, you know, the thing is, if you're for those that know the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, where you'd go at the end of training, at the end of your day, and you'd get, you know, fresh sweats or whatever, and you would say like medium roll or something. Jason is actually the guy who gets the advice. Like you go to him, you say medium shirt or whatever. Yeah, he's like you know, if you watch Ted Lasso, he's got nowhere to go but up.
He'll be coaching West Ham soon. There's three things that go into a good referral, and you guys have touched on a couple of them. One is, you know, the relationship that you've established with whoever the stakeholder is, whether it's internal or external, whatever law enforcement is. It's having a relationship with those people, so you know what their expectations are. You know, what are they interested in? What do they want to see? What don't they want you to do in an investigation? You know, when we were with the UPIC, depending on which region we were referring to, we would have our investigative plans different based on those needs. Like region two didn't want us to do any type of contact with the provider on certain cases, so that a covert operation was still, you know, in the mix if once we referred it. So that would limit what we would do or change what we would do as a UPIC. So knowing those things are important to a referral, because if you do something that they think is going to compromise anything that they're going to do in the future, then that referral is dead in the water. And so knowing those expectations, knowing their criteria, as both Wade and Jason talked about, you know, is very important to it. But the other thing that's very important is the construction of the referral package itself. It's got to be a package that grabs the attention of the recipient right up front. So having a first paragraph that grabs their attention, not with, you know, we've done data and 14% and, you know, of an anomaly that over the norm. No, it's got to be, why is this thing worth my consideration? Where's the fraud? You know, this was a service is not rendered, verified by 15 interviews who said, having that right up front as to this is the crime. And then from there, you break it down to here's how we found it. Here's how we investigated. Here at each step is how we validated what that allegation was. Here's how it meets your criteria, whether that be loss amount, meeting the elements of the law that we think are affected by the conduct, to the end of, and here are recommendations for action. Here are things that you might consider, whether that be allowing the payer to continue taking administrative actions, to, you know, breaking it down to here are other places that it could be referred to, whether that be the licensing board because you found quality of care issues, whether that be to the internal departments of the claim adjudication of the payer saying, here's a recommendation for putting in an edit to stop this, not only for this provider, but for all others because it's a program weakness. So you have all of those things in the referral. So no matter what audience it is, you're catching their attention up front and then explaining what's important about that referral and why it's supportable throughout.
So that's the important piece to me on that is that you really need to think about addressing collateral stakeholder, internal and external needs. Like, so you brought up the good point is the prospect of an edit. You want to make a referral to law enforcement and they're not interested. If your referral package addresses collateral internal departments needs like an edit, a program or a payment edit, you're basically killing two birds with one stone, right? So you're addressing all these needs. And I think, you know, the real take home for me on this is that first paragraph of it's shock and awe, right? It's punch them in the face repeatedly and let them wonder by the third paragraph what just happened, right? It's, you know, this allegation concerns the following and boom, it's $1 million in fraud. We've interviewed 10 beneficiaries. We've looked at records for 20, you know, whatever it may be. It's kind of formulating that. And sometimes that's a brainstorming situation. Mm-hmm. And it sometimes requires sometimes two or three people to sit in the room and kind of bounce that idea and say, okay, if we were, maybe it's a whiteboarding, right? If we're putting this referral together, what are the things that stand out? Okay. Is it a services not rendered? Is it misrepresentation? Is it patient harm? Is it a one level upcoding case? I mean, I can't tell you how many of those, you know, I've looked at over the years. It's a level three, but it was billed out as a level four. I mean, I think everybody will agree that if you're not falling asleep by the time you've read that, because at the end of the day, is that an argument versus something that's a little bit more clean cut? I don't know, you know, are you going to, is law enforcement going to take a case that's a one level upcoding case? But you know, where the punch is going to be, has the evidence been collected to demonstrate that there's a systematic one level upcoding because of a certain templating that's going on that's triggering that one level upcode, but the rest of it doesn't match, right? That's something. Now, whether that becomes a criminal case or a civil case, we see that a lot, by the way, collaterally speaking, on our emergency department audits. We're in the middle of doing a large number of those for a payer, and we're noticing a theme. These hospitals all have the same emergency department group or a similar group in many of them. And the templating is exactly the same. And you can actually look, if you look at records from before they created the template to after they created the template, our auditors have identified that the templating is what has caused this uptick on the one level upcode. Does that have that level of sophistication to make it interesting? Yes, but it may not be criminal, it may be civil, but you know, you're right, Matt. It's addressing all of the things that are out there and internally coming up with some sort of collaborative effort. And maybe some of that liaisoning or putting that referral together does require interaction with your internal stakeholders to identify that. Maybe the medical director's office needs to be part of the discussion on creating an edit or adjusting an edit to allow something that's otherwise being circumvented, but maybe it shouldn't be or something like that. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, referrals at the end of the day, I think that there is generally a frustration from SIUs when they have to make a referral. And I think, and Wade, I'll give you the last word. When you've got something that you're going to send over as a referral, you kind of sit back and get yourself a little red in the face over it, right? Because it's a gamble, right? It's who are you talking to that day? Are they in the mood to listen to Wade McFall's discussions about this referral, right? And you kind of get a little agita, as they say.
Yeah, and then even if they do, you know, seem excited about it or interested at first, they may have it for 6 to 8 months or a year or two. We all know this. And then for whatever reasons, whether it's interviews they conducted or just the way the investigation pans out, you're thinking, oh, they must be making progress. They've had it for a year. And then you get, you know, a declination, you know, and it's back to, okay, now, like we used to get with the OIG, take whatever action you deem appropriate. So now we're back to sitting on it for a year or two. And now we have to reevaluate and say, can we collect an overpayment? Is it education? What is it? But you've got that period where you're hopeful that it becomes a criminal case and, you know, they make something out of it. But, you know, pessimistically, you know,
right,
optimistic, I don't know.
Yeah,
it's
you know, it's funny. I always would think whenever I would send those letters back, you know, we're returning this to you for any action you deem necessary. I always equated that to when you were applying to college and you either got a thin envelope or a thick envelope. And it's like, oh, what the heck, right? Like, it's the same thing. It's like, you know, the rejection of it all.
Have a nice day.
Yeah, have a nice day. Just, you know, very, very frustrating. So, look, we've done a lot of training on this. We've done blocks of instruction with some of our SIU clients on this. So I'm putting together a good referral, the things that kind of hit home. And I think it really is, you've got to drive your point home quickly and effectively. And that shock and awe is what they need. So again, as always, ongoing conversations for our coding community. While this may not have been 100% applicable to you, you know, it's great to have some purview into what kind of is out there. For our SIU community, we're hearing some great things. We really do. As Jason said, we do appreciate the fact that SIU management is buying into the things that we're saying and encouraging their staff to watch these as training education and just kind of our musings of, you know, having all of this. I hate to say that, you know, collectively we have 150 years of experience. I think that's nonsense because collectively it doesn't matter. But, you know, we all come with, you know, I'm the baby of the group, 25 or 26 years, but, you know, we've all got, you know, 25, 26. And in Jason's case, I don't want to say it, but it's almost hitting on five fingers of experience in this space. And that's important. I mean, we're trying to give sort of what we've seen as the good, the bad, and the ugly to try to make people be a little bit more operationally work properly and, you know, keep a positive tempo. So as always, I appreciate the time that you guys spend with me on this. I wish we were actually in the same conference room together because we do have a good time. For those of you that are going to be at NHCAA, we will be there at NHCAA as we always are. You will be able to come find us. I'll be speaking with somebody from one of the blues at one of the sessions. Again, if you're not getting our newsletter, we encourage you to ask us for it. hello@advisehealth.com. Follow us on LinkedIn. You can get these podcasts as well as our LinkedIn lives on Spotify, on YouTube, and through our newsletter. August 14th, 15th, I think it is, next week. Super excited. We've got our August LinkedIn Live, Marshall Allen, author, writer from ProPublica, now an author of a book, Never Pay the First Bill, talks a lot about the intersection of fraud, waste, and abuse in the space. I'm really excited about that. If you have not read the book or if you've not seen any of Marshall's work, he's amazing. He knows this space as well as anybody. So I'm super looking forward to that, hoping all of you be able to join us at that. And so until next week, we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable podcast.
Dude, thank you.
Thank you all.